Guys, he pointed to the two armed recruits, will guard. Could I get a couple of people to help haul things across? The crowd was happy to have something to do, even manual labor. There was no shortage of volunteers, and in short order they had moved the weapons and other supplies. Soon, more people were trickling into the area. Many of them were injured and were being supported by others. It was obvious that the searchers were finding a lot of students still on campus. One of the very few pluses of the earthquake was that it had kicked the attitude out of most people. Now they were willing to stand still and listen where there was an offer of aid, food, and shelter. By now, the explanation for the gate had been repeated enough times that Aaron and Richard no longer had to be involved. As new people came to the group, they received explanations, albeit not always completely correct, for the gate and the guns. Students would discuss the situation, then one or two would take off at a run, and searchers were coming back with supplies. Medical supplies, Richard noted with approval. I think we might have skimped on those.
That's because Captain Reference can't stand the sight of blood, Aaron replied.
Kevin, meanwhile, finished setting up the second portal on the other side. At this point, he stopped, looked stricken, and said,
Oh, fuck. Fuckity fuck fuck.
Aaron looked at Kevin in surprise, this being very un-Kevinish behavior.
What? We have two portals and one generator.
Richard looked at the gate, at the generator, and at Kevin. Oh, fuck is right.
Wait! Inverter, I think the van has one.
Kevin rushed off to the van.
Yes,
he called from the cab. It took some talking to convince some students that they weren't about to be abandoned on the other side, but soon they had managed to turn off the first gate, plug it into the inverter, move the generator through the reactivated gate, and start up the second portal on the other side. Everyone was relieved when a second gate opened beside the first one on Earth. One of the students who had just returned to the group came up to Richard and said,
Hey, listen, there's a bunch of livestock in the animal sciences complex. Can we do anything about them?
Richard looked at Aaron, who looked stricken, and replied,
These gates aren't big enough to push a cow through, even if the cow was cooperative, which I very much doubt would be the case. They'd likely as not break the gate while struggling. Horses, ditto. Chickens, we could handle. Pigs, maybe, as long as they're greased.
She tried to smile, but her heart wasn't in it.
Look, Aaron, we need that livestock, so we're not going to abandon them. People come first, but once we have everyone safe, we'll come back for them. Is 2 days in a livestock building going to harm them?
If the building collapses, yes.
Oh, hell.
All right. Richard turned to the man they'd been talking to, whose name was also Richard.
Call me Dick, he said.
Hey, better you than me, Richard replied. Okay, Dick, how many people would it take to herd all the animals through a couple of miles of wilderness?
We'd lose the chickens and pigs right away, but the cattle, sheep, and horses would be okay as long as the horses were being ridden.
There are 8 horses in residence right now, I think, so 8 people minimum.
Right. Richard turned to Aaron. Aaron, we'll get everyone through, then come back with the truck gate and do what we can. Good enough?
We don't have a choice. None of this is ideal.
Richard assigned Dick the task of organizing the rescue party. Dick walked away, already calling to people and discussing details.
You know, Richard said to Aaron, there's a good chance that there are a lot of other things we should be looking for right now at the university. Seeds from plant sciences, tools and equipment from engineering, God knows what all else. You have to know we're going to think of them too late.
He looked around at all the activity.
Not that there will be time to act on any of it anyway.
Aaron nodded in silent agreement. She looked around, looked at her watch, and thought for a second. She called to some students who were standing nearby.
Hey guys, this is taking a lot longer than I expected. We won't be able to get to our warehouse camp before dark, so we're going to have to camp tonight. We'll need fuel for fires. Can you organize a scavenger party? Furniture, bookshelves, whatever. Enough to keep a dozen small fires going all night. The students talked to others nearby, then about 20 of them scattered. Aaron heaved a tired sigh.
Unbelievable. I'll have to get Bill to explain to me why this stuff is so simple in the movies.
45. Setting up and moving out. Bill stopped to stretch his back.
Getting old.
No, just greedy. How the hell did you manage to buy all this stuff in like a couple of weeks?
Matt motioned to the pallets of supplies and equipment stacked in front of the second shed, awaiting its completion. Bill grinned and pointed toward Monica, who was scanning the middle distance with binoculars.
I had help.
Monica dropped the binoculars to hang from the strap around her neck.
I think you're confused about who was helping who.
Whom?
And by the way, why are you spending so much time looking through those things? I doubt there are any predators within miles of us right now with the noise from the bobcat and forklift.
Animals are running away. Human predators, if they hear the noise, will be coming in the opposite direction.
The thugs?
You think they're still alive out there somewhere?
Don't know, Bill, but if they are, I want to shoot first, you know?
Seriously?
Matt made a face.
They'd have to survive about a week in Outland and make their way here from almost the other end of town.
Yeah, I know. Still better paranoid than sorry.
Bill nodded and looked sidelong at Matt.
Yeah, it's fine, and we can spell you if you want.
No, you boys are having way too much fun with the heavy equipment. I don't want to spoil that.
Monica gave Bill a teasing smile, then raised the binoculars again to scan the horizon.
Back to work. Matt said as Bill continued to stare. We're almost done with the shed. I want to get this inventory undercover before dark.
There was a squawk from the walkie-talkie sitting by the gate, and Matt jogged over to pick it up. He had a brief conversation with someone, then put the walkie-talkie down and walked back.
I just had a talk with Kevin over at the university. There's a situation.
Matt repeated the gist of the conversation to Bill and Monica.
Crap.
We have to save the livestock if we can, Bill said.
And not only because we're wonderful, caring human beings,
Monica added.
If we have to stay in Outland for a long time, livestock will be good to have.
You know, Matt said, I have an idea how we can make this work.
The fate of the farm animals kept preying on Aaron's mind, and she couldn't drop it. Finally, she had an idea.
What about going and getting the truck gate to get the animals across?
In the van? Richard shook his head. It'll take forever to go there and back in that thing. You remember the drive out here, right?
Kevin walked up to the two, waving the walkie-talkie.
I think we have a way to save the livestock. I talked it over with the guys at the warehouse. They've about finished moving everything across, so Matt has suggested driving the big gate over here in his pickup.
Well, hell, Richard replied. That thing can scale a vertical cliff in 4 low, and he's got the clearance to get over most of the crap I had to dodge. It'll take him maybe 20 minutes to get here.
Matt said 10,
Kevin pointed out.
He may not know how rough it'll be. Tell him to take it easy and aim for 20. What about Bill and Monica?
They'll stay in Outland to guard the supplies and keep working on the sheds. Monica says we'd better all get there with the gates or she'll be downright pissed.
Aaron smiled.
I'd be pretty pissed to be marooned on the other side, too. Kevin, please tell Matt it's a go. I'll get things organized at this end.
About 20 minutes later, Matt drove up to the group around the van. He turned off the engine and got out.
Hey, guys, what's the sitch?
Matt, this is Dick, Richard said. He's the guy who brought up the whole livestock thing. Dick, you're up.
Dick looked a little hesitant at first, but got into it once he started talking.
Okay, I've sent a bunch of Aggie students ahead to prep things. We'll ride the horses, herd the cattle and sheep. We'll put the birds in cages in the back of the pickup. We'll have to release the pigs on the other side. They're too much trouble to herd and too much trouble to keep unless you already have a good fenced-off area. We're hoping they'll go feral before they all get eaten. We might be able to trap some of them eventually and build up an inventory again. Otherwise, they'll revert to wild type in a couple of generations. Not that that's terrible, it's just that they're meaner.
Richard added,
We'll give you an extra portal generator and a 6-foot gate so you can bring both gates through when you're done. We can't give you the generator or we'll have nothing, so you'll have to hope the power is still on or there's a generator at the complex. They have some portables there, including a big trailer-mounted generator, Dick said. Good, let's bring them over. Even if you don't have room for them on this trip, leave them on the Outland side and tie a tarp around them or something. Aaron's pretty sure that the roof will come down before we can get back, so anything we want to save has to go over today. One other thing, Richard handed Dick a stack of boxes. Bill will be insufferable if anyone tells him, but these should be handy. Dick looked at the boxes labeled night vision goggles.
Who's Bill?
Richard shook his head. Just go. Dick gave Richard a thumbs up and looked to Matt. Matt gestured to the passenger side, then got into his pickup. A few seconds later, they were on their way. As they watched the pickup drive off, Richard turned to Aaron. What's that saying about the best laid plans?
The best laid schemes of mice and men, gang after glee, Aaron quoted.
Richard raised his eyebrows in appreciation of the performance and sighed. I think I'm going to have that tattooed on my forehead. I suck at this. There had been much discussion of strategies and plans while preparing and waiting for the final move. Aaron was impressed at how quickly people had accepted and adjusted to the reality of an alternate universe. But she admitted to herself that having it right in front of them helped a lot. Everyone agreed that they should continue to reopen the gate and try to find more survivors, but the words were said with haunted eyes. People were beginning to realize that once the ash started to fall, a death sentence had been pronounced. No one was willing to volunteer to trudge through ash-covered streets looking for survivors, and they had no other way to locate refugees. They had to hope that most people had done the smart thing and hit the road as soon as possible, and that the roads had been passable because they wouldn't be by morning. There were numerous requests by students to rescue their relatives, but by the time the number exceeded a couple of dozen, people began to realize that it would be impossible. At this point, some individuals ran off, either having changed their minds or hoping to bring their loved ones back before the gate was closed. They were finally done at the university. Everyone who had shown up had been moved through to Outland. When the ash started to fall, and they hadn't had a new refugee in a half hour, Aaron decided to call it a day. They moved the last of the supplies and kindling through, then shut down the portal. In all, they'd managed to bring across a little more than 250 people, mostly students and a smattering of faculty, plus two security guards who'd been on campus. The guards, Fred Mack and Anson Rutherford, were both retired cops who, according to them, had taken the security jobs to stave off terminal boredom.
You spend your entire career in the thick of things, then you retire and bam, 8 hours a day in front of the TV, Fred explained. Couldn't take it. The security job is an easy gig, good for extra pocket money, and generally the most critical issue we face is timing our breaks so we get the fresh pot of coffee.
Anson smiled in agreement.
This is the first excitement we've had since we took the gig.
He paused and looked around, losing the smile.
I'll be honest, Miss Savard. I don't think any of these kids have thought beyond the next 24 hours. They're keyed up, excited, a little stressed, but they're still thinking of it as a drill or maybe a temporary inconvenience or a bomb scare or something. If they think about it at all, they're thinking in a day or two they'll all be back at home or residence, whatever. That's not going to happen, is it?
Aaron hesitated, then shook her head.
This is, at minimum, going to create a disaster lasting weeks. That's if the eruption is a small one. At the other end of the scale, most of the U.S. could end up uninhabitable for years. In past eruptions, the ash cloud has reached from southern Manitoba to Baja California to Louisiana. And I think this one might be bigger. There's a chance that at least some of these people will never see their families again.
Getting organized had taken a lot longer than expected, and it was getting dark before they were anywhere near ready to move.
The idea of trying to shepherd so many refugees through the wilderness in pitch-black night was ludicrous, Aaron knew, and those who might have suggested it would change their mind once darkness fell. Modern urban humans don't have a real appreciation of how dark night is without artificial illumination and the resulting sky glow. The situation was made worse by the simple fact that it was summer, and people were wearing summer clothes. These were grossly inadequate for the cooler, outland night air. Aaron suggested to Fred that perhaps he and Anson should be in charge, but Fred shook his head.
No way, darling, you're doing fine. The kids listen to you. They just tune out a couple of old farts, but we'll help anywhere you need it.
She immediately deputized the two to organize security for the night. Fred and Anson discussed it for perhaps 30 seconds, then set to work. They built 8 fires in a ring and split up the scavenged fuel between them. A few people were assigned to each fire to make sure the wood didn't get burned too quickly, since a larger fire would burn through their supply much faster without providing any extra benefit.
"The fires are more for protection than for heat," Aaron said to her audience. "We want to keep the nightlife away from us, so don't get the bright idea of going around to the outside of the fire ring unless you want to be a midnight snack. Take a page from Emperor Penguins, form a nice tight group, and keep each other warm. This is no time for bashfulness. We'll also need to organize guard duty. Anyone who has ever handled a weapon should speak up. We'll need 8 volunteers for each 2-hour shift. Fred and Anson will take care of the details."
She gestured to the two, who gave her a couple of sloppy salutes and got to work. It took another hour before they had everything set up to everyone's satisfaction. By this time, full night was settling in. The first guard shift stepped up, weapons in hand, and the rest settled onto the hard ground, on blankets and tarps wherever possible, and tried to get some sleep. The nightlife in Outland was, in its own way, as loud as the day shift. The biomass of an untouched wild planet was far greater than what humans had left behind on Earth. On one occasion during the night, some tortured soul stood up and yelled at the top of his lungs, "Will you shut the fuck up?" That produced a lot of laughter from the other campers, but no more than a few seconds of relief. There were shots fired a number of times, but there were no major incidents and no loss of human life. There was one close call when a large cat almost managed to sneak past a dozing guard. A scream from an insomniac camper brought the guard back to full wakefulness, and a near miss from a full load of buckshot set the cat scrambling for the darkness. Lighter by about 2 lives and 1 dump. After a few more encounters, the local predators decided that easier meals could be had elsewhere, and the attempted incursions tailed off. But the noise level didn't abate all night. As some of the less rested would later report, the nocturnal racket segued smoothly into the morning cacophony of bird calls without a break. It was a cold, tired, sore, and damp group of refugees that slowly stood up on their first morning in Outland to discover the first of many new realities. No coffee. At this revelation, there was a near mutiny. Had a cold, scary, sleepless night and no breakfast, and many people expressed regret for having come across. On hearing the complaints, Aaron ordered Richard and Kevin to turn on the gate. As the gate opened, a cloud of dust puffed through the opening, and what looked like cigarette ash fell through. Looking through the gate, people could see a blanket of ash more than 2 feet deep. Buildings were covered in it. At least one building within sight had collapsed. Everything had a uniform gray-brown color. Aaron stared at the ash in shock, then muttered to Richard,
"That's not good. I think we're solidly into supervolcano territory now."
Recovering quickly, she took a deep breath and turned to the spectators.
"I've explained about ash-induced diseases. I won't bore you with that again. I've explained about ash-induced building collapses, power grid collapses, equipment failures, and shortened growing seasons. This isn't theory. It's happening now. Anyone can go back if they want, but they'd be a total fool. And this rescue isn't being run by some far-off government body. It's us. All of us. Anyone who has any ideas to improve things in any way, we would love to hear it. We're all working this out as we go along. Now, you want to go back? Here's your chance.
She motioned at the gate. There was a lot of motion as people took the opportunity to get a look, but no one accepted the offer.
After that, the crowd seemed far less inclined to complain. Her statements about not having any special knowledge or experience in this situation had paradoxically given people a lift. Someone yelled out,
"So where are we going?"
Aaron replied, "We have a stockpile that we moved from a warehouse downtown to this side. It's about a 45-minute walk from the university. It'll be the same distance here, but with no sidewalks and the threat of predators. It'll take a little longer."
"Can we go back once the ash stops?"
"Sure. As long as you don't need to eat or drink water. The other side is toast. There will be no clean water. There will be no electricity. There will be no food deliveries. Of course, I could be wrong, and anyone is welcome at any time to go across and check it out. In fact, we'll probably develop a system of popping across and scavenging. But understand this, please. This side is paradise compared to what used to be home."
"Is there coffee at the other camp?"
someone yelled from the back.
"There'd better goddamn be, or I'm gonna lose it."
That drew laughter from the crowd, and someone else yelled,
"Which way?"
Aaron signaled Kevin and Richard to turn off the gate. Crisis averted. She consulted the map and her compass and pointed. Fred and Anson divided everyone into groups and organized outriders to guard the procession. Richard sidled up to Aaron.
"So, what does that mean for us, the supervolcano thing?"
"More ash means more ecological damage, more destruction of infrastructure, more difficulty for FEMA and other rescue organizations. It's just worse across the board. I was hoping, if it was a normal-sized eruption, we could just stay on this side for a week or so, but not with that much ash. We may be here for a long while."
"What about the cattle drive?"
"It's about a mile from us, based on Earthside distances, and they'll be a while getting over here. When they do, they'll just follow the mess we're making as we travel."
"Yeah. A couple hundred pedestrians sure leave a trail."
"They'll likely be a half day behind us by the time we get to the warehouse camp," Aaron said. "For all that the Aggie students know about horses and cattle, I doubt if any of them has ever done an actual cattle drive. Pretty sure if Bill were here, he could come up with a lot of material."
"Then let's consider ourselves lucky he's not here."
Aaron gave him a tired smile, and they joined the march.
46. In the news. On the Nebraska Radio Network, our coverage of the Yellowstone event continues. The Yellowstone eruption is currently the most watched event in the history of electronic media. Throughout the Midwest, people hurry home to sit glued to their TVs. But in the modern era, where so much violence and calamity happens on TV without any effect on the viewer, it is perhaps unsurprising that even an event so close to home is being treated as largely theoretical. Yes, people say the pictures are dramatic, and yes, there has been an earthquake, but that is now over. There are reports of mass casualties close to the eruption, but surely we're at a safe distance. And yes, experts are predicting a fall of volcanic ash, but there had been ash from Mount St. Helens, Mount Pinatubo, and that unpronounceable Iceland volcano. The worst effect of those had been some cars needing a new paint job when owners unwisely tried to wipe the ash off. So, people invite neighbors over, set up the TV on the patio, and chat, comparing notes. Government officials continue to advise calm. Law enforcement continues to reassure, and many people, accustomed to listening to the voice of authority, take them at their word and stay put. Others have taken the issue a little more seriously, but still view it as a hunker-down and waited-out situation. There are runs on banks and grocery stores. Weapons shops are doing a brisk business, especially if they are flexible about paperwork. Home improvement stores are selling out of dust masks and respirators in record time. People are making a point of refilling their water coolers and stocking up on spare jugs of water. The smart ones will already be on their way out of town. Families that threw the absolute basics into the car and headed for the highway will be the most likely to survive what some say is a civilization-ending catastrophe. As NBC Nightly News continues, let's go to our field reporter, Christy Barnes, in Lincoln, Nebraska.
The ash has been falling for hours now. Within about 1,000 miles of the eruption, it is more than 2 feet deep and is showing no signs of abating. Buildings with flat or gently sloped roofs have started to collapse, in several cases, killing the occupants. Anyone who by chance survives a building collapse risks death from suffocation, since the collapse will saturate the air with both coarse and fine ash. Cloth is not at all adequate to filter it out. Buildings with more steeply sloped roofs so far are faring somewhat better. However, the ash sliding off to the sides builds up quickly, and unlike snow, it won't compress or melt. Building occupants could conceivably avoid a crushing death, only to find themselves entombed. For many residents, the accumulation of significant ash fall has been a major wake-up call. The number of vehicles heading out of town has surged to a level several times higher than the worst rush hour crush that city planners had ever conceived, and the resulting logjam has brought the roads to complete gridlock. Some drivers have attempted to go around the mess by unconventional driving, but have been stymied by other drivers trying to go around them. At this point, the sidewalks, parks, roads, and even lanes heading the opposite way are as gridlocked as the rest. Those with vehicles modified for off-road driving seem to be faring somewhat better. There have been uncounted reports of people abandoning their vehicles and, in some cases, attempting to hijack other vehicles. Several shootings have resulted. The death toll continues to mount.
Thanks, Christy. That's Christy Barnes reporting from Lincoln, Nebraska. In the wake of the Yellowstone eruption, there have been reports of profiteering by merchants. Many of these incidents have resulted in violence and looting. Police are overwhelmed and have stopped responding to calls unless gunfire has been reported. Even in population centers far from the Yellowstone eruption, police are reporting runs on banks, food stores, weapons stores, and construction and home improvement retailers. There have been reports of violence in cases where weapons retailers have insisted on the legally mandated waiting periods before purchasing guns. In at least 2 known cases, police stations have gone silent after initial reports of being under attack. Experts speculate that unknown groups have attempted to seize law enforcement arsenals. There have been unconfirmed reports of explosions in Washington, D.C. Government officials say witness descriptions are indicative of terrorist-style attacks. So far, no group has taken responsibility. Fundamentalist churches throughout the nation have declared the Yellowstone eruption to be the first volley in the final war of Armageddon. The unbelievers, the atheists, the idolaters are being punished. The only hope is through God, said one pastor on a local cable broadcast. It is not clear, however, that the faithful are faring any better than the average person. Critics have been quick to point out that the southern states, with their sizable fundamentalist population, will be right in the path of the ash. 47. Getting up is never easy. July 26th. Bill woke up at 6 a.m. to a new day in a new world, one filled with noisy neighbors who apparently had no concept of sleeping in.
I goddamn hate nature, Monica grumbled. Pave it all over, I say.
Bill smiled weakly. He hadn't slept as well as expected.
Having Monica right there all night had been a significant distraction from the serious business of getting some shut-eye.
"I don't suppose that ginormous coffee maker of yours will work without electricity," Monica said.
Bill sat up, letting his sleeping bag sag down to his waist.
"No, although we have generators somewhere in this disaster.
However, I present for your approval two important items. A Coleman stove," he pointed to a pallet, "and a camping-style coffee maker. No need to use a backhoe for a spade-sized task."
Monica's eyes grew rounder.
"I knew there was a reason I decided not to kill you."
She hugged him, making Bill's IQ drop by half, and went over to dig out the stove and coffee maker. It took only a few minutes to move the required equipment from the shed to the area out front that they'd fenced off the previous day. Bill brought out a couple of folding tables, and they proceeded to brew that all-important first cup. Bill always took his time savoring the first cup of coffee. Unlike some who just needed to get the caffeine in as quickly as possible, Bill wanted to really experience that initial rush. He turned to Monica, who was already pouring her second cup.
"You know, we can probably get you a bag and a needle, set up a drip, might save time."
Monica glared at him over the rim of her mug as she drained half the cup. Finally, she came up for air.
"Don't think I haven't considered it. But speaking of coffee, we're going to have a large number of caffeine-challenged students here in a couple of hours. Should we be worried?"
"I guess we're going to have to rig up the generator anyway at some point. Might as well be sooner. One more coffee first, okay?"
Monica smiled and raised her cup in salute. 48. Cattle Drive. Dick looked the situation over.
"Looks like we lost two, a cow and a calf. They must have panicked and run off. I'm pretty sure we didn't let anything get close enough to take them down."
Matt did a quick count. They still had 16 head of cattle, including four calves. There were also a dozen sheep. The horses had been tied up in their own group. All of this menagerie had been gathered into as small an area as possible. The Aggies had collected whatever they could that would burn and brought it across, but they only had fuel enough to keep one fire going all night. To keep the predators at bay, they had erected construction spotlights on telescoping stands that ran off the biggest generator. Outland nightlife didn't like blindingly bright halogen lights, so harassment had been minimal. Dick continued his report.
"The pigs are long gone by now. We can only hope they're still in one piece. They'll probably stay in the general area, so if and when we're ready to, we can come and get them."
"Greased pig roundup, woot!"
one of the other students yelled, waving his fist in the air. A couple of others laughed. Matt shuddered.
"I don't see how that's fun."
They looked over to the pickup, which was half full of cages stacked as high as could be managed, filled with unhappy chickens. The rest of the pickup bed contained the portal hardware which Matt had refused to even consider leaving behind. Dick pointed to a couple of students who were getting the horses ready for the cattle drive.
16 head of cattle. Yeah, we're real cowpokes, all right. This should be pretty funny."
"Funnier than trying to get them through the gate last night?" asked Matt.
"Oh, much. So many more opportunities on a cattle drive. Haven't you ever seen city slickers?"
Eventually, they got everybody organized. All the riders mounted up, and four students crowded into the pickup with Matt. Dick turned around on his horse, waved his hand in the air, and yelled,
"Head 'em up and move 'em out."
"Another joker. Great," Matt muttered. "Richard will have a shit."
The hike was going slowly. Not everyone was a born hiker, and many of the students were wearing unsuitable shoes. A couple dozen people had been injured in the quake and had to be helped or even carried. And some students had brought luggage, which didn't roll well on prairie grass. Over the course of the march, people tended to spread out more as the faster walkers outpaced the slower. Fred and Anson had to stop the front group every so often to let the slower walkers catch up, explaining that they didn't have enough guards to cover such a long parade. Fred also made a point of getting the fastest walkers to help with the wounded and injured, since they seemed to have the most energy to spare. By nature, the university students tended to be optimistic and upbeat, which already showed. Many of them seemed to be treating this as a nature outing. Some were taking selfies and pictures of the animals with their phones. A couple of people had actually tried to send texts, forgetting the complete lack of service on this side. Those incidents got good laughs, at the expense of the forgetful. Aaron talked with a couple of students as they walked.
"Can't believe the climate over here," one guy said. "Wetter? Cooler? Actual trees? And what are those things sticking up everywhere? Hills? Nebraska doesn't have hills. Or trees, come to that." Aaron smiled. While he might have been exaggerating, it wasn't by much.
"Different recent geological history. No humans. An extra volcano or two. I'm a little surprised, too.
I wish Professor Collins were here."
"His assistant is," another student noted.
"Oh, shit. Jensen?" Aaron asked. "That's right."
Aaron sighed in disgust.
"Yep, Bill was right. God is a B-movie director."
A flock of birds took off in the distance. People were still not used to the sheer numbers of wildlife on this side, and birds darkening half the sky made many stop and watch in awe. Almost as impressive was the sheer variety of wildlife. Half the species they encountered had never been seen by human beings, while more had been obliterated soon after encountering humans on Earth. Closer to the procession, herds of deer jockeyed for grazing position with moose, elk, and less recognizable animals. They could see some mammoths and one large cat at a distance. A pair of giant sloths a bit closer fascinated the hikers, as they were unlike anything they had ever seen earthside. Certainly nothing like their small, lethargic South American cousin. The students did, however, heed Aaron's warning to stay away and to try not to appear aggressive. At one point, Aaron listened in on an argument that a couple of people were having about the portals.
"They should be handing this technology over to the government. At least they would be able to use it nationally to save a lot of lives."
"How, exactly?"
"How what, handing it over? Or using it nationally?"
"Both. Do you have a phone number handy? 1-800-SAVE-USA? Maybe the Department of Useful Inventions for Saving the Day? Does the word bureaucracy ring a bell? If you wanted to hand over something like this, I bet it would take months of argument just to get to talk to someone who would understand you. And then, before they can use it to save lots of people, they'd have to build a bunch of portals. How? Area 51? Maybe using the alien duplicating machine?"
"Well, there's no need to get sarcastic."
"Actually, there kind of is. Sometimes mockery is the only way to get people to think about what they're saying. And by the way, what makes you think there'll even be a government in a week? This isn't Mount St. Helens. This is the stuff that ends civilization."
"Oh, you're exaggerating."
And so on. Aaron had to bite her tongue to keep from chiming in. She agreed with the pessimist, but she felt the argument was moot at this point. Kevin, meanwhile, kept the warehouse camp updated on the hiker's progress via walkie-talkie. Matt gave updates on the status of the cattle drive, which was ahead of schedule, and might even catch up with the hikers by the time they reached the warehouse camp. Aaron found Fred and Anson, who were on perimeter guard duty.
"Hey, guys. Holding up okay?"
Fred grinned. He and Anson had stayed up almost all night, each taking only a single two-hour break.
"We did any number of double and triple shifts when we were still working. This was a piece of cake, right?"
Fred looked over to Anson, who nodded in reply. Aaron put on her best casual tone.
"I was wondering, while you were still in the force, did you ever run into a trio of thugs named Zeke, Carl, and Jimmy?"
"Zeke? Zeke Peters?"
Fred and Anson both burst into laughter.
"Yeah, he's part of a gang that supplies drugs around the university area," said Fred. "They all fancy themselves hot stuff, but they'd be ground up like sausage in any big city."
He shook his head.
Carl seemed to have more brains than most of them, though. I think he was looking for ways to move up, but it always ended with him sitting and holding. Why, did you run into them?
You might say that.
Erin told Fred and Anson about the confrontation at the warehouse. She left out nothing and didn't try to excuse their actions, or their half-assed rescue attempt after the fact.
Serves them right, Anson said. They should have stuck to pushing party drugs.
I wouldn't worry too much, Fred added. No one will miss them. Worst you'd ever get is some variation on failing to report criminal activity or something, and only if the cops were really bored.
Erin smiled and thanked them. She felt better for the talk and also reassured that the two ex-cops now knew about the possibility of human predators in Outland. Eventually, Erin spotted the warehouse camp in the distance. It was hard to miss the large steel shed with another half-assembled shed beside it. The pace of the group picked up as other people noticed the structures, and in a short time they had arrived. The area in front of the sheds was fenced off, but a section had been opened up to allow access. Bill and Monica sat in folding lawn chairs inside the fence. Beside them, a generator purred, and a large coffee maker lightly steamed. Bill got up and stepped through the open section of fence. Smiling to the crowd, he waved a mug in the air and called out, "Welcome to Rivendell! Who wants coffee?"
49. In the News. Excerpt from Emergency Congressional Briefing, volcanologist Dr. Olaf Stevenson testifying.
As the ash falls and accumulates, it will kill all vegetation beneath it. Pasture grasses and crops will begin to die immediately, as will the microorganisms in the soil. Domestic livestock and wild fauna within 1,000 miles will die from starvation or respiratory illness. Freshly fallen ash floats, and it absorbs water in the same way as sand, leaving little for animals, clogging up streams and rivers. Ash will block sewers and pipes, further destroying infrastructure. Water supply and sewer systems will be quickly overwhelmed and break down. The Mississippi River, the Columbia River, the Sacramento River, and all other major North American waterways will become semi-solid sludge as the ash washes downstream, making them useless for transportation. With water, air, rail, and road transportation all unusable or destroyed, the infrastructure of society will begin to break down. Urban centers rarely contain more than 3 days' food supply at any time. Hoarding, looting, and destruction of supplies from collapsing buildings can shrink that estimate considerably. Nor will the damage be limited to the United States or even to North America. A global ecosystem already weakened and decimated by human excess will not show the same resilience as in prior extinction-level events. This eruption very probably spells the end of modern society. It may be the end of humanity. It could conceivably mean the extinction of everything larger than an insect.
50. Surviving Outland. July 28th. Zeke and Carl worked their way slowly through the berry patch. Carl was happy for the calories, and he liked blackberries anyway, but a diet heavy in berries was having unfortunate consequences on digestive systems that were used to a lot more protein and roughage.
Could be worse. Just ask Jimmy.
Carl felt a shudder at the thought. Jimmy hadn't survived their first day here. A pair of enormous cats had stalked them when they left the shed to look around. They had retreated, but the small, tinny structure folded at the first assault. The animals picked off Jimmy, giving Zeke and Carl time to run to a nearby tree. They had to watch and listen as Jimmy was taken down, then slowly eaten before he was even dead. Zeke had been enraged and started shooting as soon as he was able to get a stable stance in the tree. He'd killed one cat with a lucky shot and the other had run off limping, but it was too late for Jimmy.
They'd frisked the body for anything useful. They'd found an extra magazine, but couldn't find his gun. They didn't have any tools to bury Jimmy. In the end, they'd had to leave the body for the scavengers. Zeke still agonized over the whole episode. It had changed him, somehow. He didn't talk as much anymore, and when he did, it was about revenge against those kids. After that, life became a case of day-by-day survival. Twice they'd managed to shoot a young deer and had eaten well. A folding knife wasn't ideal for butchering, but it did the job. The rest of the time, they survived on berries and the occasional fruit trees. Fires seemed to keep the animals at bay at night, although the two men still camped close to a tree just in case. Fortunately, a lighter formed part of Carl's tool kit, the way lockpicks had been part of Jimmy's.
"And what's the point, in the end? Spend the rest of our lives running? We'll run out of bullets eventually, then what?"
And the answer always came back. "The damned kids won't abandon this place just because we're here. They'll just move. If they can connect to a different year, then we're screwed. Otherwise, we just keep watching." 51. First Meetings.
"Can I have your attention, please?" Richard bellowed at the top of his lungs.
More than 270 people sat on the ground in front of the sheds, and many of them were more intent on their own conversations. Slowly, the background buzz died down as his audience turned to him.
"Listen, we don't have a PA system, one of the few things Bill forgot to buy, so you're going to have to be very quiet and listen. I'm going to ask you, if your neighbors start a side conversation, to punch them in the arm until they shut up."
There were laughs and a few loud ouch noises.
"If you really, really feel the need to have a chat, please go into one of the sheds or to the other end of the lawn so the rest of us can get this done."
Richard waited. When there was no immediate movement and no sign of the background buzz starting up again, he resumed.
"There's no point in having a meeting like this with so many people. My voice has about 2 minutes of life left, so we're going to organize committees. If you have an idea or a suggestion or want to head up a group, please meet in front of the east shed in about 10 minutes. Everyone else, please park it somewhere else. Thank you."
Richard took a deep breath as he finished. There were whoops and ironic applause from the audience.
"So I'll never be a politician. Sue me."
He made his way over to the east shed where Bill had set up some tables and chairs. Several groups were drifting in that direction, and it looked like an argument had already started. Richard sidled up behind a couple of guys who were standing over Bill, not quite yelling in his face. He looked around and spotted Monica, who was approaching rapidly, AR-15 in hand.
"She really does like a good scrap, doesn't she?"
Richard smiled to himself. This could be interesting.
"What's the beef here?"
he said to the loudmouth's backs, forcing them to stop berating Bill and turn to face him. There was a brief silence as they had to adjust their point of view to look up.
"We want to know why the geek here is in charge," said one. "It's a completely reasonable question."
"Okay, and here's a completely reasonable answer," Richard said. "This is our place, this is our property, and we invited you here to get you away from the Yellowstone eruption. You can always leave if you don't like it here. Or we can uninvite you if we decide you're too much of an asshole. So maybe try a little common courtesy as an alternative tactic."
"And what if we don't want to?"
the larger of the two men said. Then he jumped slightly and looked down at the rifle barrel nudging his groin area.
"Then you're trespassing and I give you an orchidectomy,"
Monica said, smiling.
"Three guesses what that is."
The man frowned, opened his mouth to say something, then looked at Richard. Richard shook his head.
"Do not assume she's bluffing. There's a reason we let her carry the weapons. Actually, several reasons, only one of which is that she really, really wants to shoot someone."
The two men looked at each other, gave Monica the once-over. She grinned back, as if daring them to comment, then turned back to face Bill, looking much less belligerent.
Richard and Monica stepped away from the group but kept careful watch for a few minutes. No other altercations seemed imminent, so they walked a short distance away.
Huh. That was suboptimal, Richard said. I didn't expect that, at least not so soon.
Come on, Buttercup. There are always going to be jerks who figure they should be in charge just because. I bet you if we're here more than a week, those two will be pushing for elections and nationalization of our assets.
I'm not going to argue that, but we better be prepared. Do we have good security on the weapons?
Keyed weapon locks and cabinets, top of the line, too. Bill and I, we don't cheap out.
Uh-huh. Do we have any money left? Monica lost her grin.
Richard, money may be obsolete. I've been talking to Erin, and I don't like what she's saying. We need to have a meeting, just the six of us.
Okay. Let's maybe set something up for around supper time. Speaking of, how are we going to feed this mob?
Erin and I did an inventory, Monica said. We have enough food for the population for about 3 days, if you consider things like MREs food.
Yeah. We'll need to supplement that if we're going to make it for even a week.
Forget about a few weeks, stay. Let's have that meeting, I'm just saying.
Richard examined her morose expression silently. Monica was perhaps the most irrepressible person he knew, and this was uncharacteristic.
All right, Monica, I'll hold off on too much planning until we've met. Meanwhile, I think I'll mention to Bill that we should be doing some hunting. That'll require handing out some guns. Other than the two cops, I don't think anyone brought any over.
There's no help for that, Richard, but we can control the ammo at least, and require all weapons to be checked in when not in use. After all, they are still our property. At least for now.
You're really making me nervous, Mon. I hope that's just your prepper paranoia talking.
Me too, big guy, but meanwhile, I'm going to look around and see if I can find some individuals who can be trusted. We need to build a security force.
Richard nodded. Got it. Supper time. See you.
He walked back to the tables where Bill was bouncing around like a puppy, talking to first one group, then another.
You really need to cut back on the coffee, Bill.
Not hardly. It's the real breakfast of champions and project planners, as it happens. What's up, Richard? You have that just sucked on a lemon look.
Uh-huh. Now I remember why I don't like you. Richard waved a hand to dismiss the subject.
Monica and I were talking and we have an issue with food supplies. Have you considered hunting parties?
Bill looked around. Well, we were leaning more towards scavenging supplies from Lincoln, but there's no reason not to have parallel activities.
He raised his voice to speak to the group.
Any experienced hunters here?
A dozen or so people raised their hands and stepped forward. Bill gave Richard a thumbs up.
We got this.
Richard settled into the lawn chair with a groan.
This is even more work than gold panning. Whatever happened to desk jobs?
There were a few smiles, but no replies. The group seemed to be on a uniform downer.
Apropos of nothing, Erin said into the silence. The refugees are starting to call us the G.O. The gate owners. It's not a bad label.
I like the word owners,
Monica replied.
Reminds everyone what's what.
Matt frowned.
Listen, I like a good plot twist as much as the next guy, but aren't you maybe a little overboard with the paranoia?
Before Monica could reply, Bill said,
Uh-huh, I got some of that very narrative tossed in my face today. Dude wanted to know why I thought I should be giving orders. Luckily, Richard and Annie Oakley here showed up.
Is this what we're here to talk about?
Richard looked around the group.
No,
Erin said, leaning forward.
We're here to talk about the near-term and long-term prospects of survival.
She paused and met the worried gazes of her friends.
So far, we've been reacting to the immediate dangers, and I believe we've done pretty well, all things considered. But there's an unconscious assumption, I think, that this is a short-term thing, like a power failure or a water main break. Government will step in by and by and make it all better, and we'll all go home.
And you don't think that's the case, I take it?
Richard asked.
Aaron shifted again, trying to get comfortable on the cheap aluminum lawn chair.
We've got some experience with the effects of volcanoes. Mount St. Helens, Pinatubo, Krakatoa, any number of others in historical time. And those have been bad enough. They did significant damage and caused significant disruption to local society, technology, and economies. But they are to Yellowstone as a firecracker is to a stick of dynamite.
Wait, Aaron, how do you know this? We've had no real communications since the earthquake.
Partly theory, of course, Richard. We know what Yellowstone is. We know how big a magma reservoir it has. It's hard to imagine any mechanism by which we'd get a small eruption that produced that much ash. I had Bill open one of the gates this afternoon just to get a look. There's over 3 feet of ash on the ground, and it's still falling. And Lincoln is 750 miles downwind. This is no firecracker, guys. This is the real thing. So think about 3 or more feet of ash over most or all of Nebraska. Where do you put it? Even if you can collect it. It won't melt or compress like snow. If you pile it somewhere, it'll just blow around and continue to be a hazard. And you can't collect it anyway because heavy equipment is all dead, or soon will be. There's not going to be any recovery in Lincoln, maybe not for years. Same for any other population centers in the path of the ash. And based on geological data from the last eruption, that could include up to half the continental U.S. We have to consider the possibility that Outland is our new home. For a long time.
Son of a bitch, Richard said into the shocked silence. But how sure are you? I mean, FEMA surely has a lot of resources to throw at this.
This is a black swan event,
Monica said.
An event so singular and so huge that there's simply no point in trying to plan for it, other than in terms of simple survival. The budget to evacuate half the population of the country to the other half of the country would be more than even the U.S. could muster up, assuming they could get it approved. FEMA won't be able to handle this. They may not exist in a week. Excuse me?
Monica gestured toward Aaron, who took up the thread.
Toba blew up about 70 to 80,000 years ago. It was bigger than anything in history, even Krakatoa or Vesuvius or Thera, but not as big as Yellowstone. And it affected the climate in Africa, which is on the other side of the world, and in the other hemisphere. I think the United States is done. Likely Canada and Mexico as well. Very probably some European countries. This might be the next Dark Ages.
How will we know? Richard asked. How can we find out if there are relief efforts?
I have some ideas on that, Bill said.
Aaron, the electrical interference, that's short term, right?
Yes. No more than a couple of days of no reception, really. Another couple of days of poor reception until the crap in the air thins, but that doesn't mean TV and internet will be back.
Give me some credit, Aaron. I understand about infrastructure, Bill said.
I'm thinking more along the lines of satellite reception. Oh, sure, no problem, as long as someone's transmitting.
Bill smiled but offered no further comment.
Anyway, Aaron continued, I think we need to take a longer view. We need to set up a council of some kind with representatives from the refugees. We'll need law enforcement, which I understand Monica is already looking into. We'll need to think of long-term needs for food and shelter, and especially clean water. Look, if I'm wrong and things get organized Earthside and we can all go home soon, then the worst that has happened is we'll have kept people busy and maybe safer for a few weeks. No harm, no foul. But if we don't prepare for the worst case, and it turns out to be reality...
Damn it. Richard put his head in his hands. This is getting out of hand. I think you're right about the council thing, Aaron, and we should do that first thing, but we also need to talk about whether we're going to allow our possessions to be nationalized or whether we're going to implement some kind of feudalism with us as the property owners.
That wouldn't last long, Richard, Monica said. 6 of us can't hold off nearly 300 people if they decide they've had enough.
I think we need to stay far enough in front of this so that we can steer it a little instead of getting trampled.
Got it, Richard replied. Bill, you've already got the beginnings of a hierarchy of sorts with your work crews and crew leaders. Ask them if they or someone they know should be on this council, at least until we can have elections. 52. In the news. CNN headlines on the hour. Three known survivalist strongholds, one in Nevada and two in Utah, have declared independence from the United States. They have published an ultimatum to all military and law enforcement to leave their respective states within 24 hours or be declared outlaws. It is not clear if the two groups in Utah are working in cooperation or competition. There have been eight more instances of individuals or small groups going on murderous rampages. These latest incidents occurring in Utah and Texas. In one of the Texas events, 42 people were killed before law enforcement cornered the suspects, who reacted by killing themselves with an explosive device. In all such cases, the suspects have committed or attempted to commit suicide. OPEC has announced that all its oil shipments will be temporarily suspended until the extent of the volcano's effects have been determined. Dr. Michael Nedman of the USGS has issued a statement concerning the Yellowstone eruption. "This is far more powerful than our models predicted," he said. "We are estimating well over 700 cubic miles of ejecta in total. This would make it the largest eruption from the Yellowstone hotspot in its existence." When asked how this would affect the country, Dr. Nedman replied, "This is going to affect the planet. There has already been plenty of coverage in the news of the possible effects of a supervolcano eruption. Just triple that." 53. Planning Committee. July 30th. Richard banged on the folding table with his coffee mug. "All right, let's bring this to order. This is our first, admittedly informal, meeting of the Council of Rivendell, and you can blame Bill Rustad for that name." There were a few chuckles and some blank looks. "Let's do intros around the table. I'm Richard Nadeski, one of the creators of the interdimensional gate that got us all here." He looked to his left.
"I'm Matt Siemens, currently in charge of the scavenging crew."
"Krista Tollefson, I'm in charge of medical. I've completed pre-med at UNL, and I would have been transferring to Omaha in the fall."
"Fred Mack, retired cop. Monica Albertelli is actually in charge of security, but she's a little busy at the moment. I'm her acting assistant until things are set up, then I'm going to retire. Again."
"Anita Newman. I'm an Aggie at UNL, so I'm representing the agronomy and horticulture majors. I guess I'll oversee farming, if we ever have farming."
"Ed Tigerson. I'm in charge of scouting. We also handle the hunting. My qualifications are all informal. I've been a backwoods guy all my life."
Ed looked around the group and grinned, creases lining his weathered face.
"Obviously, I'm not a UNL student. Just got caught up in the sweep when everyone was bailing. I've got no family on the other side, so this maybe isn't as much of a horror for me as it might be for some people."
"That's a good point," Krista replied. "Most of our population is young, which means family on the other side. Right now, the shock, and let's face it, the novelty, is keeping everyone more or less distracted, but I expect a lot of anxiety and depression over the next little while. Keeping everybody busy is probably our best defense."
"I don't think that's going to be hard," Richard said. "But let's get the intros finished before I launch into that." He pointed to the next person.
"Dick Thompson. I organized the livestock rescue, so I've kind of ended up in charge of animal husbandry by default."
"Bill Rustad. I'm one of the GO, the gate owners, as we're being called. Officially, all the GO are on the council, but you'll probably never see more than a couple of us at a time. I'm an engineer, so I'm in charge of the technical aspects of our life here."
As Bill finished, Richard sat back in his chair and picked up his tablet to resume his talk. "We've got a list of items to discuss that's going to take several days to go through, I think. For starters, we won't be using tablets over the long term.
Those will be reserved for gate-related activities, so we'll need stationary supplies. He looked at Matt. We should probably go over the list of required items offline, unless something comes up in this meeting. The council really doesn't need to hear the details. Krista raised a hand.
I have my own long list. Maybe each of us should submit their own list to Matt, and he can take it from there.
Good idea. That'll save some time. Richard put his tablet down and paused to look around the table. Now, the really big item. You've gotten some of the story informally, and Aaron Savard will do a presentation to the council later, but the bottom line is that we're going to be here a long time. We can scavenge from Lincoln in the short term, but we're going to have to think about building our own industry, our own agriculture, and so on. Matt leaned forward on his elbows.
We'll be looking for people on Earthside as part of our operation and offering them an opportunity to cross over with us. I'd like to be able to explore farther afield looking for survivors, but I'm not sure if that'll even be possible. We'll know more after a recon or two.
We also have some immediate concerns on this side. Bill made sure he had the floor, then continued. Latrines. We're going to overwhelm the ones we've already set up, and frankly, we'd be better off setting up a proper septic field downhill of any potential water supply. Which brings up the second item, clean water. He motioned to Matt. You'll need to bring across any bottled water you find, but that's just a stopgap. We need a well and proper filtering and disinfection. I have a list for you. Bill paused and looked down at the paper in his hand. And look for containers of bleach, anything with sodium hypochlorite listed as the main ingredient, as long as it doesn't have perfumes or colorants. One jug can disinfect hundreds of gallons of water. You'll need to make this a priority.
Medical supplies are also a priority, Krista said.
Which means, Matt said, that we should be scoping out vehicles and fuel supplies first. Bill shook his head.
Doesn't do us any good with a limited number of gates to bring stuff back and forth. Richard held up a hand.
Let's not start arguing about competing priorities. Matt, any formal plan is just going to get argued to death. Your time is better spent going out there and getting supplies and equipment. You've heard the discussion here. You'll get lists from each person. Use your judgment.
Locating items and bringing them across will be a bottleneck, all right, Matt replied. We only have my pickup truck on this side and nothing on the other side. Even if we can find working vehicles and locate keys for them, I'm not sure the streets are navigable with all the ash. It's going to be slow going if we have to hump everything to a central location. And until the ash settles, everyone who goes Earthside will have to wear masks and goggles, and we have a limited number of those.
I have some ideas that should help with some of that, Bill said. Matt, meet me at the Mad Science Lab after the meeting. Richard, you too.
Bill's Mad Science Lab was in a section of the east shed that he had set aside. All the portal hardware, as well as various tools and items of equipment, formed a maze that greatly reinforced the informal name. When Richard walked up, Bill was playing with the pole cam while Matt held the control tablet. Matt turned and wordlessly handed the tablet to Richard. On the screen, a video window showed the exterior of the group's warehouse in Lincoln. Another window displayed the GPS coordinates of the location. Richard shook his head and handed it back to Matt, then said to Bill, "You really like the dramatic reveal, don't you? Same principle as the camera?" Bill grinned back.
Yep. I have one of our GPS receivers wired up to the pole cam. When everything is powered up, I can crank the external antenna through the gate with this.
Bill pointed to another piece of rigging on the pole, similar to the one that was used to tilt the camera forward and back.
It picks up the GPS signal Earthside, and voila!
Richard shook his head. Engineers. Jeez.
So the scavenging party can use the pole cam to scout and to determine locations from this side
and to communicate with the Earthside search parties from this side, Bill added. I've also rigged up an external antenna for the walkie-talkie. As long as the pole cam is open, everyone has full cross-dimensional communication.
He smiled in triumph.
so we can determine locations using GPS, Matt said. Drive to that location on this side, then gate things across. This will greatly minimize exposure to the ash and allow us to get a lot done without worrying as much about walking around with masks. Richard squinted at the small gate on the end of the pole. Plastic film stretched across the aperture blocked the steady fall.